Session number 9407.
Mr. White, reels 2, 3.
We had learnt a lesson, theoretically, in the movement, some of us, about crowds and mounted police. That when the mounted police charge people, a crowd of people, or try to, not at the gallop, but when they try to push in to the crowds, instead of the crowds pushing away and running away and opening up and letting the horses through, the thing to do is to stand firm. Horses won't trample on people unless they're blindly driven to it, as they are these days with blinkers on and so on. Normally a horse wouldn't trample on people. And if you press in closely to the horse on both sides and in front, the constable with a truncheon, he can only hit one side at a time, and he can only hit those people that are a certain distance from the horse. He can't hit them that are close up to the horse. And whichever side he's going to tackle, the other, if you're all around him, the other side would stay close anyway and get hold of his foot, just knock his foot out of the stirrup and heave, and the man is off. It's as simple as that. Because that's theory, and not easy to get a lot of people to put that into practice, but it was done.
Did you see that actually happen at Cable Street?
Yep.
What happened to the chap when he came off the horse?
Well, there was a crowd round, you see, and milling, and then other foot police were fighting their way into him. He got up and the skirmish went on, but he wasn't hurt. His helmet got kicked around a bit. But
how did the police behave at Cable Street?
Well, they had their job to do. They were under instructions, you see, and they had to support Mosley, come what may. And they weren't, I don't think they were as vicious as they are today. I've been on the picket line, the miners' picket lines, and I've seen what goes on there. They weren't as vicious as that. They weren't shielded. They had helmets. Most of them didn't have a helmet, even the horse police. Just had their truncheons. Of course, they had to carry out their orders. That was recognised.
Now, leaving Cable Street, you joined the Balham CP in 35. Were you a member of the Balham CP right up to going to Spain?
Right up till 19, to the end of this year. I did 50 years, completed 50 years in the Communist Party.
In the Balham?
All the way through. No, not the Balham. No, but in the Communist Party of Britain.
But how long were you a member of the Balham branch?
Well, come to that. I think I should mention first that in the AU, in the Wandsworth branch, I was elected a year after I joined it as a delegate from there to the Wandsworth Trades Council. But the Wandsworth Trades Council refused to allow me, to accept me as a delegate, because I was a communist. My branch refused to elect anyone else, and they said I was their delegate. So there was an impasse that existed until after I came back from Spain. When the Spanish war broke out, right from the early days of it, we were waging a campaign. We organized campaigns in our area, in support of the Spanish people, Aid Spain. We set up a sort of ad hoc Aid Spain committee. And we conducted these campaigns. We got marvellous support from the people in Wandsworth, collecting food and money. And we held rallies. We even got the use of two of the new cinemas, the Odeon, and I forget what the other one was called. In the Odeon was in Tooting on Sundays for nothing, for Aid Spain committee meetings for the public. We packed those cinemas every Sunday with people and collections and money, and oh, it was marvellous. We conducted that campaign all the way through, and it went on all the time the war continued, went on. And it had, of course, it had political connotations as well. Nevertheless, that was the situation until in 1936, when the first British volunteers out there formed the beginning of the British Battalion, and the International Brigade was started. I applied to my party to go. Now, the Communist Party, although they weren't all just communists that went to Spain, we know there were Labour Party people and others, non-political people. Well, not non-political, but non-party people who went to Spain. But it was the communists who, in agreement with the French Communist Party and the Spanish Communist Party, controlled the people going to Spain, because it was no good to the Spanish people or anybody else for anybody and everybody to go flooding out there for all kinds of spurious reasons. To do what? They had to be people with a real fundamental idea of why and what they were doing and why they were doing it. And they had to be people with some discipline. And the Communist Party and we members of the Communist Party prided ourselves, and we have done all the way through, as being people with commitment, with integrity, and with discipline. Self-discipline, as well as social discipline. And, of course, the recruitment for that, if you can call it as such, was being done by the Communist Party in London. Dave Springhall was the representative of the District Committee of the Communist Party then.
That's the London District Committee?
Yes. And he conducted a number of meetings in the Wandsworth area, and he was through him that people were offering to go, applying to go, volunteering, and then of course they were, you know, sorted out and talked to and found out who they are and what they are and why they're going, want to go, and so on. Then some went. Some got through the net, some didn't.
So was Dave Springall trying to recruit people for the International Brigade then?
Well, yes, the Communist Party wanted people to go out there, same as the Spanish people wanted then, wanted volunteers. Because of the earlier volunteers that went out individually and that were already in Spain, like Ralph Fox and a number of people, who were fighting with the militia, people's militia. Naturally, they were, and they were trying to build, then they trying to build up the International Brigade to as a to be a stiffener for the Spanish people's army. Because we were, they didn't lack courage. The Spanish people had all the courage in the world. And they fought. They stood up and fought men, women and children, unarmed. But they required, you couldn't conduct the war as it turned out then against Franco's troops, Mussolini and Hitler's troops, whole divisions of them, fully armed. You couldn't conduct a war against them with a sort of militia, untrained militia. So we had to provide that stiffener, that example. We couldn't fight the war on our own either. But we set an example, we gave encouragement to the Spanish people when they saw us there with them, and we were more or less disciplined.
So how did you come to be recruited to the International Brigade?
Now, I volunteered in the early days when they were starting it. But I was asked then by the Communist Party, because I wouldn't do anything like that without the agreement of the Communist Party anyway. So I volunteered. And then I was asked if I would hold it because of my experience having been in the Navy, because they were then considering manning one or a number of vessels for the Republican side, make up the complements of those with volunteers, see. So therefore, I was asked to wait until this was in order, and then I could volunteer, because at least I'd had small arms training and was good with small arms, and I had discipline. So I held back, but it was very difficult to hold back, especially when I saw the losses that were going on and the requirements. And then in 1937, the situation was, there were quite a lot of losses of the British there, and they needed more volunteers very badly to take their places.
When had you first volunteered then?
In 1936.
Do you remember the month?
No. No, I don't. But it was along about the middle, or, you know, later in 1936. I think it was several months anyway after that I got hold of Spring Hall at a meeting, and I said, look, I want to go and you need them out there. And he was saying, yes, we need volunteers. We really need them now.
Did you have an interview?
Yes.
Who with?
With Spring Hall. And through him, finally with Robson.
Was this at King Street?
At King Street. And so they agreed that I should go. And 3 days afterwards, I went. Now, they told me I had a passport. I had been to France a number of times. And I went on my own, as it were, on my passport. Normally, most of the volunteers had not got passports, and they were going on weekend passes, ostensibly for the weekend. But of course they were singled out on the boat, even, by the spies. And when they got to the other side, a good proportion of them were stopped by the French from at the barrier, as it were, when they got off the boat, and they were sent back. All kinds of excuses were given for it, but nevertheless, this happened to them, a lot of them. I sailed through, I was supposed to have assisted half a dozen who were going on the same boat on the same day. I didn't know them, didn't know their names, but I was told they were going to go on that boat and that I should look out for them. I would be able to tell who they were. Most of them would have a copy of Titbits in their pocket on their hands. But when we got to the other side in France, I was to sort of take over, lead them, you see, and up to Paris and help them through. Well, I saw them on the boat. I never approached them or anything. I saw them. And I got off and I went through the customs. And I went and sat on the train that waited, you see, for all the passengers. None of them appeared. Finally, the train left. We went to Paris and never saw them. So they were all turned, that six were sent back. I reported to the headquarters in Paris.
Which headquarters?
Now, I can't remember. It was the party headquarters, a headquarters which they had established with the trade unions as well, in Paris. And from there, we were sorted out. We were quartered for an overnight. We were fed during the day. A couple of days we spent there, one night. And then the second evening, a group of us were taken to the station, put on the train down to Perpignan. I was the only Englishman among that particular draft. I never knew no one else.
Could you speak to them?
Some of them, yes, because some of them were could speak English, but they weren't English people. Mainly there weren't many French, but there were some Italians, there were one or two Germans, there were Yugoslavs, all mixtures of people, you see, that were going.
Did you learn anything from them?
Learn anything?
Yes. About who they were and so on?
No, because we were on this train, packed on this train, and we were trying to get our heads down, tell you the truth. I did chat to one or two, but very much on the surface. When we got to Perpignan, we were taken off, met, given a meal, and then we were put into a barn. And we had to stay in that barn all day long, pretty hot. In the evening, a couple of coaches came, picked us up, and took us straight through, over the border, into Figueres.
With no problem?
No problems at all, no. Travelling overnight, and of course, getting into Spain is very different, according to the day, a time of day, and the party, whether you got through easily or whether you had it the hard way or whether you got turned back, it depended on who was on duty on the frontiers, the French side, and all these factors came into it. We were fortunate because we just got on and our coaches just went through. Others never had coaches, they had to walk, climb through the Pyrenees overnight and run the gauntlet, you know, of being picked up, and a lot of them suffered injuries and so forth. But for me it was simple. From Figueres we were sorted out, went to Albacete, which was the brigade headquarters. There we were kitted out to the extent that we were kitted out, and spent 2 or 3 days there. And then we were sent up to a village on the way to the line. Again, I don't remember the name of that village. We were just there one night.
This was not Madrigueras?
No, not Madrigueras. It was something Flores, I think. But these details I could probably get from our publications.
So you said you got to this village?
We spent the night there. We were quartered in the church throughout the night. In the morning we were due to undergo some training, and we had half an hour, I think, trying to train us the use of a rifle and whatnot, which of course was not very adequate. But then we were rushed because they were in dire trouble at the Jarama front, the battalion. So we were rushed up to the front. And I got up there, and I got up to the line, which was then a sunken wall inside of an olive grove.
Sunken wall?
Wall, yes. There was a slope, and then there was a wall and a terrace. And olive groves. The fascists were dug in opposite that. They hadn't been able to advance any further, and they dug in where they were, and the brigade was just dug in behind this wall.
Do you know the dates that you arrived in the line?
Not the actual date, no. It must have been around the... I was wounded on the 27th, so I think it must have been the 23rd, 24th, somewhere around the 24th.
1937.
I didn't take any notice of the dates at the time. And so I had that 3 days in the line. I was put in the section comprising Australians and New Zealanders. Because of my experience in Australia, I was put with them.
Were you the only Englishman in this unit?
Yes, in that section.
What was the name of the unit?
It was a section, you see, of a group.
A section of a platoon?
No, of a group and of the company.
Do you know the number of the company?
No, it was the Clematley Company. Well, originally it had been the Sacravala Company, and then the name was changed to Clematley.
Can you remember the names of any of the people who were in your section?
Just one, and that was the section leader, who was Ron Hurd.
How did he spell his name?
H-E-R-D, I think.
Was he an Australian?
He was Australian, yes. And there were several New Zealanders and two other Australians.
But how many were in the section?
That I couldn't say, really. Because it was also... You know, we got there. I got in the line. We were under fire, shell fire, coming over all the time. We were behind this wall. We had to man our outposts, and you know, we were getting settled in, and so I was settled in with these in the immediate section, these people, and there was activity going on. And then on the 27th we were ordered over the top into an attack, or a diversionary attack, to take the heat off, as I understood it at the time, to take the heat off the Americans who were on our right flank, who had been attempting to attack the left flank of the fascist salient. You see, they were attempting to break through that salient on the left. They went into the attack and they got pinned down, and they were getting slaughtered. Because they got nothing, just our rifles and a couple of machine guns. And whereas the fascists had got cannons, they got machine guns galore and everything.
Could you see the slaughter amongst the Americans?
No. Not because of the groves, and the terrain was such that we couldn't see it going on from where I was. I never saw it, but we were told about it during the forenoon. And then we were told, by midday, we were told we'd have to go into an attack. I didn't even know the names of our commanders there, English commanders. I hadn't met them then. They were there, but I hadn't come in contact with them. But the order came through to our section leader, said, right, well, we're going into action. Why are we doing it? We're not going to take that salient, but we're going to cause a diversion. So we had to get over this wall and then run through the olive groves as far as we could or thought we could, zigzagging, trying to find some sort of cover to get behind. Olive trees, probably 6-inch diameter at the most, trunks, most of them smaller than that. So they were no cover. And the hail of bullets coming from the other side, as soon as we started, you could hear the bullets through the trees as we ran. I zigzagged and ran as far as I thought I ought to, and